This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
House sends an article of impeachment to the Senate, charging former President Donald Trump with inciting the storming of the Capitol. China warns of risking a new Cold War if the new U.S. President Joe Biden follows the protectionist policies of his predecessor, Donald Trump. And Australians take to the streets in major cities to protest the country's National Day. That's its indigenous population, marks as British Invasion Day. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. House of Representatives has formally presented an article of impeachment to the Senate, accusing former President Donald Trump of inciting the storming of the Capitol earlier this month. The Senate impeachment trial is the second of Trump and the first ever of a former president. The upper chamber of Congress is expected to start the trial proceeding on February 9th. Democrats are narrowly in control of the Senate, but at least two-thirds of the 100-member body is required to convict Trump. If convicted, a separate vote will be required to block Trump from seeking office again. That vote would only need a simple majority to get passed. A number of Republicans have questioned the constitutionality of the impeachment. Trump is also expected to challenge the trial in the Supreme Court if convicted.
The Democrat-led lower house of Congress has forced a second impeachment trial in the Senate for ex-President Donald Trump on charges of incitement of insurrection following the deadly protests inside Capitol Hill on January 6th. There is seemingly no chance that a supermajority two-thirds of the Senate, which is evenly split between both parties, will vote to convict Trump this time either. Recent polls show America is almost evenly split on if Trump deserves a conviction, meaning the trial will be yet another highly divisive political event.
I think Democrats are basically taking this opportunity to once and for all kind of like rally around that, like, this person is, like, you know, evil, he's bad for the system, this is a terrible president to send. They're really just trying to hammer down that you can't get away with this stuff. This, and the president in his own words really did, like, rile up these people to come to the Capitol and, you know, wreak havoc. It's more of, I think, what they're going towards is, like, you can't come here and touch us.
Analysts suggest that Democrats may be pushing the trial as a way to weaken the Republican Party by forcing Republicans to openly choose between pro-Trump and anti-Trump factions. Conservatives could be weakened by infighting for years. Trump remains incredibly popular among Republicans, but a conviction would forbid him from holding office and running for president in 2024. Given the record anger, disunity, and polarization, many wonder if a successful conviction could backfire and provoke even greater problems.
All it really does is creates a vacuum for another figurehead to kind of go in there and take control of this mob of quite literally fascists. This is like fascism in actual definition. And what this does is, you know, we know Trump is a con man. We know Trump was often like bumbling his way through things. He was kind of like, you know, a joke, a mockery of the system. This unfortunately creates a vacuum where someone more competent in terms of just, you know, oppression, repression, can take control of this vacuum that Trump is leaving behind.
New President Joe Biden is being criticized for allowing Congress to focus on a trial instead of creating legislation to cope with a raging pandemic and a once-in-a-century economic disaster. Many fear the controversial trial will eliminate willingness for bipartisanship in a Congress in which Democrats have only a very slim margin of control. That's a different agenda than Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first 100 days in 1933, when he rolled out 15 major pieces of legislation, which began the so-called New Deal and economic recovery. The trial will begin on February 8th and must dominate the proceedings of Congress until its conclusion weeks later. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The U.S. Justice Department has launched an investigation into whether its officials improperly sought to help former President Donald Trump overturn the election results. The announcement came after reports emerged suggesting that the acting Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division had plotted with Trump in a failed bid to oust then-Attorney General Jeff Rosen. The plot was aimed at launching a probe into alleged voter fraud in Georgia. Trump refused to concede defeat in the 2020 election, with his campaign and other Republican allies claiming the vote was rigged in favor of a Democrat, Joe Biden. In the meantime, Dominion Voting Systems has filed a $1.3 billion defamation suit against Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, for spreading lies about a widespread election fraud. U.S. President Joe Biden has predicted the coronavirus-related death toll in his country would eventually be well over 600,000 before scaling down with mass vaccination.
I feel confident that by summer we're going to be well on our way to heading toward herd immunity and increasing the access for people who aren't on the first on the list, all the way going down to children and how we deal with that. But I feel good about where we're going, and I think we can get it done.
Biden also expressed hopes for administering 100 million vaccine shots for the coronavirus in his first 100 days in office. The remarks came as the world's worst-hit country surpassed the grim milestone of 420,000 COVID deaths. With an average of some 68,000 new infections every day since the pandemic began, the U.S. has so far recorded over 25.2 million cases. The University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation has also warned that the U.S. death toll may hit nearly 570,000 by the beginning of May. Mexico's coronavirus death toll, meanwhile, has surpassed 150,000. That's the fourth largest in the world. Fatalities jumped after Mexico on Monday recorded nearly 660 new deaths in 24 hours. It also registered over 8,500 new infections during the same period. Mexico's total COVID cases are now above 1.7 million. The capital, Mexico City, is one of the hardest hit areas. It is currently struggling with a shortage of oxygen tanks and hospital beds due to soaring infections. Cases have jumped there despite restrictions in place since mid-December. Non-essential activities have been suspended since then. The European Union says it is no longer recognizing the Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as the interim president of the South American country. The EU's 27 states said in a joint statement that Guaido is only part of the democratic opposition. The bloc downgraded his status, citing his loss as the head of parliament following recent elections. Guaido's recognition as the interim president gave him access to Venezuelan government funds confiscated by the West. Following the re-election of President Nicolas Maduro in 2018, Guaido declared himself as the interim president with the backing of the U.S. and the West. Maduro's allies took control of the assembly after an election that was boycotted by the opposition. Guaido is still seen by the U.S. and Britain as Venezuela's rightful leader. Political commentator Danny Shaw says Guaido is a puppet controlled by the world's long-running colonial powers like the U.S. and Britain.
The absolute audacity of the United States and England, two of the long-running colonial powers in South America, the Caribbean, and around the world. They think it's still 1824. This exhausted strategy of the Monroe Doctrine, where they think they can dictate to every country in South America and the Caribbean, economically and politically, their destiny. The Venezuelan people, the Venezuelan Bolivarian leadership have extended an olive branch once again to the Biden cabinet, but Biden is opting for this exhausted strategy. We saw Carlos Vigio, the emissary, the representative of Juan Guaido, at the inauguration in Washington last Wednesday, and now all of the European Union countries are dropping their support for Guaido. But the fact is the U.S. needs Juan Guaido because this is how they funnel billions and billions of Venezuelan revenue through PDVSA and Citgo and Venezuelan gold. This is highway robbery, and they justify it through this self-proclaimed president who's nothing more than a U.S. puppet.
The Chinese president has warned his American counterpart, Joe Biden, that he risks a new Cold War if he continues with the protectionist policies of his predecessor, Donald Trump. Xi Jinping said threatening others and imposing sanctions will only push the world into divisions and even confrontation. He was addressing the World Economic Forum held virtually. Xi made it clear that China would not be dictated by the U.S. He said that China would not be swayed by criticism of its human rights record either. China and the U.S. have been at odds over a host of issues in the past months. Those issues include trade and Washington's military presence in the South China Sea. Beijing is also critical of Washington's boosting ties with self-ruled Taiwan, which China views as part of its territory. Political analyst Qingdao Zhu says the U.S. is unlikely to change its policy toward China.
Most people would say it's unlikely to change for the United States. It's two different issues here. On one hand, it's really about the U.S. foreign policy. They have this propensity, you know, to intervene in internal affairs of other countries. On the other hand, of this issue is really about China-U.S. You mentioned about whether there will be a Cold War. I think that's exactly the issue facing not only China and the U.S., but also the whole world. I don't think the rest of the world, they won't have a Cold War. Somehow the countries will be forced to choose between China and the United States. Remember, it is not China. Instead, it's the United States which wanted or tried to launch a second Cold War against a different country now, this time around, against China by Donald Trump. But unfortunately, they failed. It's now the topic is really about whether the Biden administration will inherit, will continue those anti-China policies, by a Trump regime.
Thousands of Indian farmers, many on tractors, have staged a march into New Delhi to protest against the government's agricultural reforms. Protesters clashed with security forces while trying to roll into the capital through three entrance points. Police fired tear gas to scatter the flag-waving protesters, but they breached barricades and made their way into the city. The rally was launched after an annual parade marking India's Republic Day. The government says that the new laws will boost rural incomes as they further open up the agriculture sector to the free market. But farmers say that the legislation will destroy their bargaining power and will expose them to threats of big corporations. Munawar Zaman in New Delhi says what the Indian farmers want is a concrete solution to their problems, not just the abolition of the new laws.
There have been several number of talks, at least 11 rounds of talks happened between the central government and the farmers' union. Without all the talks end without any conclusion. So they had asked the permission from the government. So the police had given them a permission. But today the protest has turned a little bit ugly. There are reports that tear gas shells have been fired at protesting farmers, and several incidents of stone pelting has been happening in other parts, like Singhu border, which is nearly close to Delhi, at least 35, 40 kilometers. There has been reports that thousands of people started converging as early as 8 a.m. in the morning and tried to surround the capital city of New Delhi. This is happening amid the New Delhi is celebrating its Republic Day today. So it looks like the farmers are adamant on their demands. Earlier, the government has agreed and told the farmers' union that they will put all the laws, the farm laws they have passed, they will put all the laws on hold. But the farmers' union denied everything. They said, no, we need a concrete solution. Maybe after some time, maybe after a year or 2 years, you will start passing this farm law again because you have the majority in the parliament. So we need a concrete solution. We need laws that will safeguard and secure our future, because at the end of the day, India is an agrarian country and 70% of its people are directly or indirectly connected to the farm sector.
People in major Australian cities have protested the country's National Day that marks the anniversary of Britain's arrival there. Demonstrators came out despite coronavirus rules restricting gatherings of over 500 people. In Sydney, police said five people had been arrested, including one charged with assaulting an officer. January 26 is officially recognized as Australia Day. It marks the arrival of British settlers on the continent more than two centuries ago. But Indigenous Australians brand the occasion as Invasion Day. They see the British arrival as the beginning of their pain and suffering. Each year, rallies are held to call for an end to what is seen as the mistreatment of Australia's indigenous population. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says that his country has no plans to hold talks with the new U.S. administration, and it's up to Washington to make a decision.
The ball is in the U.S. court. The U.S. left the negotiating table back in 2018 during the Trump administration. So it is up to the U.S. to decide whether the new administration is going to follow the same bankrupt policy of the former administration, or the new administration wants to open, you know, a new page.
Majid Tahtarawan, when she was speaking with NBC News, he said as soon as the U.S. fulfills its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran will return to the full implementation of its undertakings. Last week, the U.S. Secretary of State designate Anthony Blinken said that his country would return to the deal if Tehran goes back to compliance. However, he said the U.S. and its allies could use the nuclear accord to seek what he called a longer and stronger agreement with Iran. That is why Blinken's deputy has expressed concern that Washington has lost its credibility in negotiating with Tehran. Former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Senior EU officials contact their counterparts in the new U.S. administration to discuss plans to try and preserve the Iran nuclear deal. Experts are saying that there will be big economic benefits if the 2015 accord is put back on track. Jerome Hughes has more.
They are clearly very different issues, but EU foreign affairs ministers have agreed the two main policy areas on which they want to make progress with the United States are climate change and the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The ministers have just concluded face-to-face talks on the subjects in Brussels.
From climate change to Iran and JCPOA, and the most important ones, the most urgent ones, and the ministers are ready for a new start.
That new start is necessary because of Donald Trump's hate-fueled anti-Iran campaign during the past 4 years. The former U.S. president pulled Washington out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions designed to try and cripple Iran's economy. Firms across the European Union have made it clear they very much want to do business with the Islamic Republic. Economists say U.S. banking-related sanctions against Tehran are stifling that business. There is now some optimism that change is coming because Joe Biden has indicated the U.S. will rejoin the nuclear accord, which was signed by Iran and six world powers in 2015 and underpinned by the United Nations. With the possibility that U.S. sanctions against Tehran will be lifted, EU businesses should prepare to start trading, experts suggest.
I think it probably makes sense to move now and to be one of the early players in the right framework, of course.
With a population greater than 80 million people, Iran represents a big opportunity for EU firms, it has been pointed out. The 27-country bloc, which is heavily dependent on energy imports, could also address fuel security issues.
Iran would have its energy fields, its gas and oil, which are huge, some of the biggest in the world, opened again to markets, in particular the European market, which would be, you know, a beneficiary of this.
Tehran says Washington can only rejoin the JCPOA if there are no preconditions. Since entering the White House last week, Joe Biden has already spoken with Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron about the nuclear deal. The big unknown right now is, will Biden be willing or able to stand up to those who want to see the agreement completely disintegrate? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The new U.S. government has approved all transactions involving Yemen's Ansarullah movement for the next month. The move comes just 1 week after the previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump designated Ansarullah as a terrorist organization, sparking an international outcry. The Treasury Department has said foreign banks would not be exposed to sanctions if they knowingly conduct or facilitate a transaction for the Yemeni movement. Many aid groups and international organizations have demanded the U.S. revoke the decision, saying that the move would put millions of lives at risk. The U.S. is already facing criticism for its military support of the Saudi-led coalition that launched a devastating war on Yemen back in 2015. Yemenis have also protested the recent U.S. move against Ansarullah and its backing of the Saudi regime for its war crimes. And that is for World News. That's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of this series. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's outstanding characteristic, namely, his refraining from being introduced as marja or source of emulation by ulema and his students. Today, we will continue the same topic. Stay tuned. One of the customs in seminaries is that, after the demise of a source of emulation, other qualified ulema usually hold the session of ifta, meaning that, in a special session, they issue fatwa for various subjects. In this way, other clerics and ordinary people understand who is qualified for being the next source of emulation. But Imam Khomeini seriously opposed this custom. Late Ayatollah Ebrahim Amini said, "It was customary among the sources of emulation to hold sessions for answering religious subjects, but Imam Khomeini didn't hold such a session. Naturally, we liked him to hold such a session because it was one of the features of being a source of emulation. However, we were sure that he would not accept. So I told him, some of the jurisprudents who used to attend the classes of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi do not attend other classes, and their studies have halted. If you allow, I will invite them to come to our house a few nights a week to ask jurisprudential issues as that you help them with their problems. Of course, I had meant the session of ifta, but I didn't mention it lest he might not accept." After finishing my words, the Imam looked at me and said, "Mr. Amini, I didn't expect this from you. I expected you to tell me that I am old and my death is close, so I should think of God and the hereafter, and reforming myself and fighting my mean desires. Now you're telling me such words? By the way, what do I need the session of ifta for? If someone asks, I will answer myself. Imam Khomeini maintained that accepting to be a source of emulation would put a heavy responsibility on his shoulder. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Hamid Rouhani says, one of the Iranian ulama came to Najaf after the passing away of Ayatollah Hakim and told the Imam, some of the clerics of Tehran have sent a message to you, meaning saying that your inattention has caused people to refer to others after the demise of Mr. Hakim. They wanted to warn the Imam to do something if he intended to become a source of emulation. But he said, give my regards to them and tell them the more you distance people from us, the more we are comfortable and the lighter our duty and responsibility will be. Another custom in seminaries is that after the demise of a source of emulation, the guardian of the seminary is appointed and announced. In other words, the jurisprudents who accept the guardianship of the seminary will naturally be known as the source of emulation. Although Imam Khomeini was quite qualified for this position, he refrained from being introduced. Hujjatul Islam Mas'udi says, after the passing away of Ayatollah Burujerdi, the top ulama held a meeting and everyone accepted to assume part of the affairs of the seminary. After the meeting, the Imam's son-in-law, Mr. Eshraghi, asked the reason for his refusal, which the Imam answered, nothing. Others are there to handle the affairs of seminary. Mr. Eshraghi was upset and left there. We told the Imam that he had a lot of students who have expectations from him, but he rejected. Mr. Eshraghi said later on that the Imam was very happy and told him, I am happy because the seminary has found a guardian. There are people who will pay the tuition of the seminary, and I am comfortable. Imam Khomeini used to pay tuition to the students in proportion to the amount of money he had. Once, Mr. Eshraghi asked him to pay part of the tuition of the students through borrowing money. The Imam said, I don't need to put myself in trouble. Mr. Mas'udi, Khomeini also narrates a memory. Once there was a meeting for tuition of seminary students, Imam Khomeini had also attended the meeting. When he came back, we asked him if he had accepted part of the tuition by borrowing money. But he answered, I will never do this. If money comes, I will give the students. Otherwise, there is no need to put myself in trouble. Almighty God is the protector of seminary. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Muhammadi Gilani said, after the demise of Ayatollah Burujerdi, for a while, Imam Khomeini was not content to publish his manual for emulation, although we begged him, saying that our families are his emulators and they need his manual for their religious deeds. The Imam would say, let me be a teacher. Another custom in seminaries is that the sources of emulation send envoys to the Hajj to answer religious questions of the pilgrims. But Imam Khomeini refused to do this. Hujjatul Islam Qarahi says, when the Imam was in Najaf, it was customary among the sources of emulation to send an envoy to the Hajj. Mr. Nasrullah Khalkhali insisted that the Imam should send an envoy, but the Imam refused, as it was a clear act for introduction of sources of emulations. Thank you.
the debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kabat Hawaii. Scotland has called for another independence referendum. Meanwhile, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said that he will be visiting Scotland soon to see if he can have this separatism rejected. The question is, with the UK itself suffering from an economic downturn, COVID-19 and Brexit, can it make its case? Meanwhile, the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said that the UK may become a failed state. First, let's get more on this story from Rob Carter, who's a correspondent joining us from London. Rob Carter, obviously, we have on the one hand the Scotland's independence bid to come into the picture again. Of course, then what the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said. If you can forge those into one quick response, please.
Sure. Well, obviously, Gordon Brown has issued a stark warning here. The reasons behind his warning are essentially bottom line. That many people across the UK just simply do not trust Westminster. They do not believe that politicians are competent enough to run things, and there seems to be a huge identity crisis growing across the kingdom. Obviously, as you've mentioned, there are independence movements springing up, and they seem to have increasing amounts of success, particularly in Scotland and Wales. But also in the north of Ireland, unification push is at an all-time popular height, according to polls, but also the economic damage caused by Brexit and the COVID pandemic. With all of these things, spiraling out of control, it seems, many years in the future, we could see a very disunited kingdom if the United Kingdom actually exists at all. So a stark warning from the former Prime Minister, which may seem a bit over the top for the time being, but when people's livelihoods are struggling and they lose hope financially, which, as we've seen, is happening now, then, of course, things could look very different in the future, possibly lead to some kind of dissent. But the future of the UK could be the next big crisis that this kingdom faces in the very near future.
Thank you for that, Rob Carter. We appreciate it. Let me bring in author and commentator John White, who joins us from Edinburgh. John White, welcome. We're looking at the referendum call again from Scotland, the first minister to call it. Tell us about the significance of this timing, if you can, and what that spells for the UK at this point in time. Okay, Derek Conway, who joins us from London. He's a former MP and presenter. Derek, let me address this question to you then.
I think the United Kingdom is far stronger if the nations that make it up stick together. But I think we have to face the fact that the younger generation want their politicians to be more accountable. Really doesn't matter which country you're in. And they want decision-making to be nearer to them. So if you're a young person living in Scotland, Westminster and its raging old Etonians like Boris Johnson seem light years away. You might as well be governed from the moon. And each year about 55,000 people in Scotland of my age group are dying, and 55,000 young people are becoming eligible to vote. And so the change in opinion about whether Scotland remains part of the UK as it has been for 300 years or goes it alone is going very much in favor of those who want to see it break away from the rest of the United Kingdom.
Okay, now we do have John White joining us from Edinburgh, author and commentator. John White, Nicola Sturgeon says that she hopes for a strong performance by her Scottish National Party in an election in May. That's going to give her the mandate to hold a second referendum. Is doing so within her mandate?
Absolutely, it is within her mandate. The mandate was actually achieved with the Brexit vote, in which 62% of Scots, which translates to every one of Scotland's 32 local authorities, voted to remain. And the idea that we can be ripped out of the EU against our democratic wish and will by a significant majority is anathema to the very principle of democracy. So for me, this prolonged experiment in semi-feudalism at home and colonialism abroad is nearing its end, and high time too. This country is not fit for purpose. 100,000 and counting COVID deaths tells its own grim story in this regard. We have a Tory government that is more akin to a death cult pretending to be a government. It's every utterance at the start of this crisis back in February, March, was made with the health of the economy rather than the public in mind. And since then, we have suffered from its criminal negligence. And I think that Scotland's independence is a matter of when, not if.
Well, Derek Conway, former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, seems to think otherwise. He's saying that the Scottish National Party would have a democratic mandate to hold a referendum on Scottish independence, that he did not think that the SNP actually has that mandate. Why is he saying that? And this is, of course, saying he also said that if it wins May's Scottish elections as expected.
Well, politicians, and he's a former prime minister, although he's a different political party to me, and I was with him for 25 years in the House of Commons, and we all dance around on pinheads. I think it's ironic your other contributor would want to go away from being a fiefdom of Westminster, being a fiefdom of Brussels. But I think there is a basic point that when in 2014 the Scottish people decided by quite a clear margin to remain within the United Kingdom was then within the European Union. Now that we've left the European Union, I think the moral case for saying the Scottish people are entitled to a say again is quite strong. I mean, at the time, everybody said that 6 years ago that this was a vote for a generation. Well, 6 years is clearly not a generation. But the ground rules have changed because of our withdrawal from the European Union. So I think, although Westminster wants this issue to go away, and Boris Johnson will use every trick in the book to avoid having a referendum on this matter while he's still Prime Minister, I think the fact remains that the mood in Scotland will just grow stronger and stronger. Personally, I think they're wrong. I think it would be a great shame. And I think the next generation Scotland will pay bitterly for those with deep chips on their shoulder who are very happy to take a very large amount of support from the English taxpayer but aren't quite so happy to stay any longer part of the Union. And they'll find the world is very cold outside the UK.
All right. Well, John White, the reports indicate that Prime Minister Boris Johnson is going to be traveling to Scotland to see if he can make it his case. But he's going to be going on very shaky grounds, basically looking at what's happening with the UK. You're talking about coronavirus, talking about an economy that is reported not to go through double-dip recession. What can Boris Johnson say to Nicola Sturgeon to avoid this from happening, as it's called a separation?
Well, for a majority of people in Scotland, Boris Johnson and his ilk is the virus. That is the real virus that is the root cause of all the ill that facing Scottish society. This is a prime minister, this is a political party that's presided over record levels of poverty, child hunger, homelessness, rough sleeping. They are taking Britain on a rocket ship to hell. These people are lost in the mists of time. They're consumed with British obscurantism. The Brexit is an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Britannia ruled the waves and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. And Derek is wrong. He is the one who's about to find out that the world is a cold place outside the largest free trading bloc in the world. And we're already seeing that. Ask small businesses if Brexit is a good idea, who are suffering the dead weight of added bureaucracy and costs. Ask the fishing industry, ask hauliers if Brexit is a good idea. Ask the 3 million workers whose employment was dependent on Britain's membership of the single market. This is what happens when theory meets reality. And as I say, there's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. And the idea of the breakup of the UK is very much an idea whose time has come. Boris Johnson has got nothing to say to Nicola Sturgeon other than set a date, because it's clear now that the momentum is towards Scottish independence. And if Boris Johnson tries to deny the democratic right of the Scottish people, who are a partner nation in the UK, not a province as Tories would have us believe, then he is headed for a sticky wicket, because he will then become the greatest friend that Scottish independence could have and the worst enemy that the UK could have.
Well, I'm going to use again Derek Conway. First of all, do you have a response to what our guest there, John White, has, Derek Conway?
Well, I think there's a big assumption in that contribution, which is if Scotland leaves the United Kingdom, it can automatically rejoin the European Union. And I don't think that's a given by any stretch of the imagination, because the balance of the Scottish economy would not fit with the requirements of the European Union as they presently stand. And so it's a question of whether the European Union would want to take on yet another country that would be a taker of resources rather than a giver of resources. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the Spaniards, for example, will have a very strong view on that, because they don't want to give any encouragement to the bits of Spain that would like to break away and be independent. The Catalonia movement will be watching very closely what happens. And so I think Spain would almost certainly use its veto to say to Scotland, well, no, you're not coming in back in. You're part of the UK, and you've got to make your own way in the world. And then Scotland will find itself an extraordinarily small nation in a big globe. I mean, yes, Britain may have interesting challenges ahead on the Brexit. We'll have to wait and see. But at the end of the day, it is 67 million people, and that's a big bit of economic clout, whereas Scotland would not be anywhere near in that league. So there are many people in England, actually, wish they could have a vote in the referendum, and there are many people in England who would be saying, well, if that's how you feel, off you go and get on with it. And I think the attitude of Scotland to public expenditure, for example, will come under very, very heavy pressure if they didn't have the weight of the English economy and the City of London, which we all hate and loathe and mock bankers, but at the end of the day, they generate an awful lot of tax revenue. And that's what pays for all the social measures that our friend is arguing for, and I agree with much that he says, but I don't think it's quite as straightforward. This is a decision made on resentment for the past and chips on shoulders about old Etonians. Then it'll be very short-judged indeed.
John White, is it true the way that Scotland was just painted by our guest there, Derek Conway?
No, this is what English nationalists would have us believe, that Scotland is not big enough or rich enough or smart enough or resourceful enough to go its own way. This is not about what is easy. This is not going to be easy. Nobody's stupid enough to think so. This is about what is necessary. Scottish independence is now a lifeboat. Derek talks about the tax. The fact is, we don't have a just tax system in this country. The rich are not taxed nearly enough compared to their wealth. We have rising levels of inequality. This country is not fit for purpose, as I've said previously. Lack of social and economic justice, food banks, demand spiralling. This pandemic, the way the government's handled it, the fact that we were unprepared to deal with it, this is the fruits of 40 years of Tory party free market ideology. When Margaret Thatcher said infamously that there is no such thing as society, 40 years on, we can see that this was not a statement of fact, it was a statement of intent. And her successors have done their damn best to make that come to pass. That is why we are suffering such grievous mortality, such grievous crisis in the wake of this pandemic. And as I say, it's time for Scotland to go its own way. Scotland is more than capable of going its own way. You don't judge a country by the size of its population or the size of its economy. You judge a country by the size of its idea. And the idea that underpins the majority strain of Scottish independence is social and economic justice.
John's emotion is perfectly reasonable, and I have a considerable amount of sympathy with what he's saying. But at the end of the day, sometimes economics overrules emotion. And like him, you know, let's mock the super rich. I've got no time for them. Why should I? But the fact is that 1% of the richest people in the United Kingdom contribute 26% of the government's income. So it's all right to say to the people, oh, take your richness and your yachts and your big houses and go somewhere else. But when they take that money somewhere else, where does that income come from? And what Scotland would find, of course, is many of its richest people would disappear. And then the government would find itself more than a quarter short of the money it wants to spend on very good and deserving budgets. So a degree of economic reality has to come into it. And that's what happened in 2014. But I think the emotions will be very different when there actually is another referendum, which I reckon would probably be in the next 2 years, and Scotland will then have to find out if it's quite as easy as people are leading them to believe.
So the economic consequences would be great, as our guest there explained, John White, if you agree with him, like his Derek Conway's statement of 1% that contribute to 26% there. I mean, is that the reality?
No, it's not. If the economic consequences of staying in this union are even greater. Call me old-fashioned, I'm an old-fashioned lefty, I would introduce a ban on capital flight. The rich can go wherever they damn well please, but their money stays here, because after all, they made their money in this country. They made their money from the public realm, i.e. the public education system for their workers, the road system, the infrastructure, etc., etc. So they can go wherever they want, but their money will stay here to be invested in...
No, it won't. It's not, I mean, they tried that. You know, when Harold Wilson was Prime Minister of Britain back in the 60s.
I'm just laying out your division of an independent Scotland that I aspire to. I understand that's not the SNP's vision. I'm not a supporter of the SNP. I'm just giving you my aspiration to show that there is another way. This is not the best of all possible
worlds. The internet stops all that, John. The internet stops that. When Harold Wilson was Prime Minister, he had controls of taking your money out of the country. But then there weren't computers in those days. Today, when the Scottish referendum was due to be announced at 10 o'clock in the evening, at 10 to 10, anybody with serious sums of money will simply press a button on their computer keyboard and the money will be gone. And it's saying we're going to stop them taking their money, we'll teach them. It won't be there. It'll be long gone. That's what was going to happen when Jeremy Corbyn nearly became Prime Minister. Banks had whole teams of people working for their richest clients who would have had their money out of the country before the 10 o'clock news announced that he'd become Prime Minister. That's a serious concern if you're trying to balance the books and the Treasury.
Well, this race to the bottomism is part of the problem, isn't it? And it's not just about the tax revenue. That's not the way our government generates money. We have our own central bank. I advocate Scotland to become part of the European Economic Area so that we can have our own central bank and our own currency so that we can print our own money. That is the way ahead. MMT, modern monetary theory. We don't have to rely on tax revenue alone. We can print our own money via central bank, and we can use that to invest in public services, in jobs, and in the future. That is the way ahead as far as I'm concerned. As I go back, I go back to what I said earlier. This is not the best of all possible worlds, and on the contrary, this is the worst of all possible worlds. There is an alternative, and the Chinese have shown that alternative, which is sustainability, managed capitalism, not in terms of the politics, but in terms of their approach to the economy.
Very well. We got just a few minutes left. I get a feeling you're not a real fan of former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Derek Conway, but I have to ask your reaction to what he has said, because it's pretty eye-opening. For example, how he said dissatisfaction is so deep in Scotland that it threatens the end of the United Kingdom. Do you agree?
I think so. I mean, Gordon Brown's a perfectly decent man. I don't think he was a very impressive Prime Minister. He was a much better Chancellor of the Exchequer. So I don't have any quarrel with Gordon Brown as an individual. And I think on this, he's probably quite right. I mean, the trouble is that the SNP in Scotland are very popular. They've pretty well wiped out the Labour Party. The Conservative Party is now the second political party in Scotland. And Nicola Sturgeon, their first minister, seems to be very, very popular with people. And so I think, as in all things, politics is personality. And if I were a Scotsman, I wouldn't like Boris Johnson and his old Etonian accents and his posh friends and all of the things that would make the average Scotsman go, oh, I don't want that running me. And so the balance of personalities is not good at the moment. So I think the United Kingdom is in some danger. But I think if the United Kingdom were to break up, which would in essence just be Scotland going, I think Wales and Ireland would stay with England, then I think they would still be a very, very strong economic entity and free of the shackles of Brussels, which in Edinburgh they want to wrap themselves around again. I think the contrast would be very startling. Never forget that Venezuela had the fourth richest oil reserves in the world, and look at the state of their economy now. So even with lots of money, politicians can still make a mess of things.
Okay. Last question, I think, is going to go to you, John White. When you take a look at the whole situation concerning the UK, Scotland, and the EU, what do you foresee in order to give us your picture as to what we're looking down in the future here?
Well, when historians come to analyze this period, they will mine a poetic irony, which is that rather than the harbinger of a new golden age that Brexiteers argued it would be, Brexit is the last brick in the wall of this 19th century colonial theme park. Scottish independence, as I say, is now certain. It's an out and about the political struggle to make it happen. Boris Johnson and his rancid Tory establishment will not be minded to issue a Section 30. The last referendum was too close to call. And Boris Johnson, or whoever succeeds him, if he does decide to resign, as some people are saying he's going to do, but if it's Boris Johnson, he will not want his legacy to be dominated by the fact that he is a Prime Minister who, quote-unquote, lost Scotland. The Scottish independence is nigh. It's been a long time coming. The cultural differences, the political differences across the regions and the constituent nations of this state are far too great and far too far-reaching. And the crisis at the heart of the British state is only being accelerated by COVID. So, as I say, Scottish independence will happen. It will not be easy. Nobody should be be delusional to think it would be, but it's not about what is easy at this juncture in history. It's about what is absolutely necessary.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That does it for the debate. Let me thank our guest, former MP and presenter Derek Conway. Thank you for your comments. And author and commentator there, John White from Edinburgh. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the debate. From me, Kavita, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balawa. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يا ابن آدم كن وصي نفسك في مالك واعمل فيه ما تؤثر أن يعمل فيه من بعدك
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, O son of Adam, be your own representative in the matter of your property and do about it whatever you want to be done with it after your death.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. One of the things, profound things, and very beautiful things which we learn from Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, is the concept of courage. We find, dear friends, that bravery and courage is a quality which is very special in Islam, and overall in humanity, we find that courage and bravery is a very beautiful thing. Now, of course, don't get me wrong, if people take courageousness and bravery to one extreme, it is called foolhardiness, meaning foolishness, right? I'm going to be brave and stand in front of a car. No, that's not brave. That is foolishness. And of course, on the other side of this spectrum, the extreme of courage and bravery, is to have none, which is being cowardly. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he teaches us the most perfect balance of courage. And it is interesting, but it is like a mountain, for example. So one side of the mountain, which is on the bottom, is one extreme, which is the downside of courage, which we said is foolhardiness, being foolish. And the other side of the mountain is another low point, which is called fear and being cowardly. And the middle, which is the perfect balance of courage, is the peak of the mountain. A very beautiful image, if you can imagine. So Imam Ali alayhi salam has taught us the peak of courage, but the peak of courage, which is the middle path. In the Battle of Badr, we find it was one of the early battles in the history of Islam, in which many atheists and polytheists of the Quraysh were killed at the hands of Imam Ali. It is related that Jibra'il, the archangel Gabriel, was also present. It is narrated that all the Muslims in this battle heard Gabriel saying out loud with a voice that all could hear, "There is no man more valorous, more brave, more courageous than Ali, and there is no sword sharper than Dhul-Fiqar." In other places, it